Hello, good evening, and welcome to Tube Talk.
A few years ago, a great event took place on Broadway when Miss Ethel Merman stepped before the footlights on opening night of Anything Goes and Kill the People with another great Cole Porter song, I Get a Kick Out of You. The Vims Carr Group lends 8 voices in recalling that occasion. I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you? Some folks like perfume from Spain. I'm sure that if I took even one sniff, it would bore me terrifically too. Yet I get a kick out of you. I get a kick every time I see you standing there before me. I get a kick, though it's clear to me you obviously don't adore me. I get no kick in a plane, flying too high with some gal in the sky is my idea of nothing to do. Yet I get a kick out of you.
Is much too sad to be told, but practically everything leaves me totally cold. The only exception I know is the case when I'm out on a quiet spree,
fighting vainly the old ennui.
And I suddenly turn and see your fabulous face.
I get no kick in a plane, flying too high with some gal in the sky. Yet I get a kick out of you.
Frank Sinatra, I Get a Kick Out of You, cut from the CBS radio program The Vims Vitamin Show. And that was the Vims Choral Group you heard in the background there. That's from April 12, 1944. A slightly slower version of the Cole Porter classic than you usually might hear. A nice way to get started. This is Tube Talk on WRCA 1330 AM. We are dedicated to the preservation of antique radios, good music, and the people who enjoy them. My name is Paul Burish. Thanks for joining us tonight. We appreciate you visiting. So come on into the parlor. I've got a nice fire lit. I warmed up the radio. A nice big Philco 37116X. I've got your favorite station tuned in. Nice and cozy. Sink right into that big chair. Just sit back and relax. That's nice.
I someone who loved me too.
Love me too.
The way you used to do. But each time I go out with someone new, you walk by and I fall to pieces. You walk by and I fall to pieces.
Patsy Cline, 1960, her first session under her new contract with Decca.
Jeepers, creepers, where did you get those peepers? Jeepers, creepers, where did you get those eyes? Gosh, y'all, get up, how did they get so lit up? Gosh, y'all, get up, how did they get that size? Golly gee, when you turn those heaters on, woe is me. Got to put my cheaters on. Jeepers, creepers, where did you get those peepers? Oh, those weepers, how they hypnotize. Where did you get those eyes?
When was the last time you ever heard somebody exclaim, "Jeepers Creepers"? That was Al Bileto. And this is Tube Talk. We do have a guest this evening. A little more music, and off we go.
Only have eyes for you.
maybe millions of people go by, but they all disappear from view.
Dinah Shore with a beautifully soothing version of the classic, I Only Have Eyes for You. We're pleased to have Gerald Nachman, author of Raised on Radio, with us tonight on Tube Talk. Book was published by University of California Press in 1998, and you can still find it. I found a copy of it, certainly, and I enjoyed reading it. I knew a lot more about old-time radio when I was done with it than when I started it. So, Jerry, I'd just like to say welcome to Tube Talk. Thanks for being our guest tonight.
Thank you very much. One little correction to start off with. It's published by Pantheon.
Pantheon. Very good.
The last book I did on the Ed Sullivan Show was published by UC Press.
Very good. Well, it's on Pantheon.
I appreciate it.
And I'm sure you can Google it up and pick it up off the Internet as I did. Mm-hmm. And, Jerry, maybe you could start us out a little bit with telling us how you were inspired to write the book. I know in the beginning of the book you talk a little bit about your childhood experiences with radio, and there's a lot of radio enthusiasts start out. It starts in a room with a little radio, listening to it when your parents didn't really want you to.
Right. Well, it actually began, I was thinking of writing a memoir, and so I started writing about my childhood, of course, and then I started talking about writing about the radio shows that I remembered, and suddenly that took on a life of its own, and I abandoned the memoir and decided to write about radio, which in many ways, as I say in that introduction, I remember much more clearly and more vividly than I do the other parts of my childhood.
Well, it's funny the things you do remember. When I was first starting to get interested in radio, I was listening to Mystery Theater. E.G. Marshall was a big show for me.
Oh, yeah, right. CBS.
CBS Mystery Theater. And I was picking up Gene Shepard out of New York, and that was kind of a treat. And I was doing this on an old tube set that I had grabbed from a great uncle of mine who unfortunately had passed away. So it was a good entree into it. And, you know, one of the remarks I found that you made early in the book, very interesting, you know, that radio was really yesterday's Internet. It was a mass media, you know, net as in network, like the radio networks. And it really was one of the first things that linked all Americans together all over the country.
Yes, it did in many ways. And it came along at an important time. I mean, its popularity increased during the Depression and kind of drew the country together in many ways, I think. And it just did connect the country in ways that it had not been connected before. I mean, there were movies, but those are, you know, show up at your neighborhood movie house, and I guess there's the vaudeville and so on. But this is the thing that really helped unite the country in a certain way.
Well, you know, I always am amazed that a lot of the radio technology and as well as the entertainment that came out of the Depression, which was a very difficult time in the history of our country, also, you know, World War II. And despite, you know, the Father Coughlins and some broadcasts that were probably not great you know, ways to bring people together. I'd say radio was probably more of a binder than a divider amongst the country.
Yeah, well, guys like Coughlin divided the country, I think, but he was an anomaly. Mostly, and I in my chapter on Amos and Andy, I point out that their popularity was largely based in the beginnings on the fact that they were a couple of guys from the South who had gone north to look for work, and they were struggling during the Depression, and the show was on every night, and people really bonded with them, and it became kind of a touchstone for a lot of American listeners.
You know, and it certainly gave people a lot of stuff in common that they didn't have before. Even if you met somebody, you were traveling, you were on a train, or you were in a different part of the country, you could strike up a little conversation, and I guess certainly you could talk about the weather, but then you might say, well, oh, by the way, did you hear Jack Benny last night? And,
exactly.
Oh, yeah, I heard that show, and
oh,
do you like this one? And he's my favorite character, and, oh, I like it when this one's on. So it's funny because my dad joined the Navy very young and fought in World War II, and he was telling me that some of his first fighting before they really encountered the Japanese involved having fights. Basically, there were about three guys on the entire ship who lived north of the Mason-Dixon line, and they would get in these arguments with the guys from the south who wanted to listen to the country music programs and Roy Acuff and the girl with the long-handled guitars.
I think in those days people had more of the same taste, partly because of radio, because we all heard the same shows, the same jokes, same comedians, the same musical programs, and, you know, news and drama and whatever, cowboy shows, detective shows, and so we all had the same experience. So it really was a great bonding power.
And some of the great events that were broadcast live, you know, the Schmeling-Lewis fight, the Hindenburg disaster, and certainly all the war news. For the first time, there was a mass media in place during a major world conflict, and which is a phenomenal thing, really, when you think about it, that people who had to always wait for news or wait for newspapers or, you know, now they could get it instantly. It was an amazing development.
Yeah, that's something else that it has in common with the Internet.
You know, and one of the other little tidbits I picked up at the beginning of the book, you mentioned that these are really time capsules, not nostalgia pills. And I like that a lot because I've always viewed old-time radio and a lot of the programs as sort of a little prism that you look through and you can see not only some of the history of the time but the popular culture of the time and get a real feel for what people were thinking about at the time.
Yeah, what made them laugh and what moved them. And also, a lot of the shows have a lot of the cassettes you can rent, buy. I have the commercials on them, and that tells you an awful lot. And, you know, cigarette commercials, things like that. That makes it kind of a time capsule too.
You know, I always get a kick out of some of the cigarette commercials. I think it's Chesterfield does some of the Dragnet shows, and you know, you hear Bing Crosby, well, whether you're going away for a week or just a weekend, pack a couple of cartons. And I'm just thinking of, imagine going away for a weekend and packing a carton of cigarettes. But
I know. Well, as you say, that really tells you a lot about the pop culture, just the shows, but what was on people's minds and how people lived them.
And that was pretty common. It was probably a disaster if you did forget your cigarettes. And you know, the other thing that strikes me a lot is how little things have really changed. Though there's, you know, every generation likes to think of themselves as being more advanced than the previous generations. But if you look at some of the shows on radio, then you turn on the TV and what do you have? Crime shows, soap operas, contest and talent shows, you know, Dancing with the Stars, quiz programs. It's the, you know, TV ripped off radio mercilessly as far as some of the ideas. And granted, you know, the programs are done differently, but it's all the same stuff.
Well, radio really was the template for all that, for everything that, as you say, that is still the same formats today. And you know, they've all changed and have been updated in various ways, and not always to their benefit. But because I really miss, you know, that's part of what the whole appeal of this of old radio is, and shows like yours, is that it really is such a shame that we've lost all that, and there's nothing like it now.
Yeah, well, it does still exist. It's, you know, you can download shows on the internet, and then as you mentioned, cassettes and CDs.
Like, there's no contemporary version. It didn't, you know, just because TV came along, why did that have to mean the end of radio?
I know.
I never understood that. And in Great Britain, they still have a lot of dramatic shows on the radio, and I think variety and comedy shows, too.
Well, you know, now that you mentioned it, I was on vacation. This was a few years ago, but I was down Cape Cod here. We're up in the Boston area. And I was tuning around on shortwave, and the Canadian Broadcasting Company had on a serial, and it was in the afternoon, and it was about some guys who were involved in conflict, I think, over in the Middle East. And I'm just like, well, why doesn't this fly here? And you know, probably a lot of it is Madison Avenue and how the executives, you know, drive the business, and TV is where we're going to advertise, and that's where we're going to try to push people to go watch, and we're not going to put good advertisements on radio, or we're not going to sponsor programs. We don't want to do that scene anymore.
Well, yeah, TV just kind of swallowed everything up, I'm afraid.
Now, the way you did the book, you know, you cover shows and performers really by program type is how it's chaptered, and there's so much ground to cover. You know, maybe we could just talk a little bit about some of your favorite shows.
Sure.
By genre. What would you rate as some of the better comedy shows? You know, personal favorite of mine is I love Jack Benny. Not only did it run for so long, you know, the jokes are still pretty fresh for the most part, and I get a kick out of the characters. You know, the characters are just so...
Well, the four shows that I loved then and I think hold up the best, one is surely the Jack Benny show. Another is Burns and Allen. And another one is The Great Gildersleeve is a great favorite of mine. It's probably my... With Jack Benny, almost my favorite show, and I can't exactly say why, but it was a little deeper than just jokes, you know. It was really pure situation, and also Fred Allen, of course, was very unique. His stuff doesn't hold up so much because he was doing a lot of topical satire, but the jokes are still good, and also Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen. The writing is very sharp on all those shows.
One of the favorites I like is the Bickersons with Don Ameche, and I can't recall the name of the female, but it's
Langford.
Yeah, it's very realistic. You know, I mean, I think a lot of people could relate to that. And, you know, the other thing that I notice in when we look, especially at the comedy shows, and Benny is a good example of this, and you mentioned this a little bit in the book. You know, a lot of the jokes are at the expense of the lead man. You know, they're at Benny's expense. There's not so much humor today is based on using foul language, or it's mean humor. It's based on picking on somebody for some reason or another.
Yeah, it's much coarser. The whole culture is so coarse now. It's really a different world, unfortunately. And that's one of the great appeals of that stuff, of those shows, is that they didn't need that. They couldn't have done it anyway, but they didn't need it. They had to write around it. They had to be much more clever, and you know, they could get away with a few little innuendos. But it wasn't really about. It wasn't driven the way that you know, sex jokes and so much humor now is.
Well, you know, the other thing that's interesting too, and I guess if you were around in those days, or you really had a good collection of old time radio programs, a lot of the themes that run through them, you know, they'll come back to things. You know, they'll go off on different topics and tangents, and then they'll come back to something that was 20 weeks ago, and we'll make it, you know, Jack will make a joke about something he said. And everybody knew, because they were such loyal listeners, exactly where that came from, and you get another laugh out of it.
Yeah, they could set up jokes. They had running gags. They had all kinds of clever devices. You know, that's, I don't know if it's totally lost now, because if you watch a very good show like Seinfeld or Curb Your Enthusiasm, I mean, they still do that. I think the better shows still use those devices.
Now, what would you say in the realm of detective and police shows? Any favorites there?
Well, let's see. I guess at the time, I don't like it. It doesn't hold up very well with The Shadow, of course. But I like Nick Carter. I liked Gangbusters.
Mm-hmm.
This Is Your FBI. Richard Diamond with Dick Powell. Let's see, what was that? Oh yeah, True Detective mysteries. They had real mysteries, and they were a little less hokey than the ones that they wrote.
Yeah, I don't think I recall that one. I'm a fan of Dragnet, and
Dragnet was a huge favorite.
And
probably my biggest.
And I often wonder why sometimes.
Crime show.
It's so dry, but it's sort of that whole, you know, you look at some of the programs we have now, it lays the groundwork for these very...
Well, Law and Order is really very similar to it in many ways. The opening especially.
Oh, the music was great, and it's very understated, and it really makes you listen, too, because it's not so overpowering. A lot of the dialogue is very terse. And, you know, it was a sort of a departure, I guess, from some of the other programs.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why I liked it so much.
I liked the Fat Man, too.
Well, with, who was the, I can't recall.
Oh, I forget his name.
When you say Fat Man, I think of Sidney Greenstreet, because I know he was Nero Wolfe.
Right. No,
he did Nero Wolfe.
The Fat Man on the radio. I forget who played it, but it was a very popular show.
No,
it's a very good show.
It's interesting that you mentioned Nick Carter, because we actually, I played an episode here. I had a couple of folks who I was going to speak with one night, and they canceled, so... We pulled Nick Carter out in an emergency, and, you know, it's kind of a formula story, but, you know, they're interesting stories, and there's some things you wouldn't think about finding, you know, a dime store detective doing, and that was an interesting one, too, because they had the lead, Lon Clark, pretty much did the whole show. I think he did the whole run of the show. He was always the lead character. He never switched. And then
well, those shows, you know, they're only half hour long. Detective shows now are an hour, so they could get a little more complicated. So that tends to make them a little gimmicky, and they have to have kind of a little twist at the end, you know, a Henry-like twist at the end. So they're not quite as fleshed out as the detective shows on TV now. Because a half hour, you know, minus a commercial, doesn't give you a lot of time to develop a plot.
Yeah, you really got to make it happen. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasons that they might be good for the modern era in that, you know, you don't really, if you don't have a lot of time, you can get right to it, you know, and it's wrapped up and it's done. And, well, what do you got for next week?
Yeah, very efficient, very efficiently and very succinctly written.
And maybe one of the biggest areas that I admire out of a lot of the old-time programs is in sort of the horror and suspense type programs. One of my favorites, I love Lights Out, and I have some recordings that even today, you know, if I put the lights down and I get in the right mood, I mean, they'll make your hair stand on end if you really...
They're very scary. They're very gruesome. I was amazed when I played some of those. Even today, they would be considered pretty gruesome and pretty, gory. Inner Sanctum, too. And I like suspense, which is a little more plot driven and less sensational, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess one of the reasons that they could get away with quite so much on the Lights Out was that was a late night program, and I guess they figured not quite
sure
so many
right.
people.
Kids weren't listening.
All right, turn off your radio if this is going to be too much for you. But Obler
a good one called The Mysterious Traveler was very scary.
Yeah, I have a few of those, and The Whistler was a pretty good program too, The Whistler.
The
Signal Oil Company presents The Whistler.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
Well, maybe you could talk a little bit about Lights Out, where that's one of my favorites. I mean, Arch Obler was a fascinating character, and I mean, apparently you were saying, you know, he'd have a dinner party, he'd take a break, he'd go upstairs, he'd write a show, he'd come down again at 1 a.m. and be ready for another cocktail.
I don't know that much about it. I think you're probably more of an expert on it. I mean, I listened to a few of them, but it wasn't one I listened to regularly as a kid.
Mm.
I was more a fan of suspense, and I listened to The Whistler because that was a great gimmick. And as radio freaks know, that was a woman who did the whistling.
which all goes to this whole, you know, the mind can be a little bit more effective, I think, than the eye sometime in scaring you. You had a nice a comment, you know, I was talking to Stephen King, I think, about what he enjoyed, and he was a fan of Lights Out. And he was saying, you know, nothing could have looked as horrible as that squeaky door sounded, you know, which kind of goes to this whole idea.
Exactly. He was a fan of radio. He was old enough to remember those shows, and he was hugely influenced by those shows and probably made him the writer that he became.
And I think it all goes to creating the image and putting it in your mind, and it's probably a different image in everybody's mind, but I think another little line was in there, you know, you go to the movies, and you can almost imagine the guy in the monster suit, you know, you see the zipper sticking up over his shoulder, but when it's in your mind, I mean, it is so realistic and so frightening.
That's right. That's what he said. You couldn't see the zipper on the up the back of the of the Man from Mars or whatever it was.
And then there was this whole other realm. They were very popular, especially during hard times, too. A lot of these quiz programs where somebody might win a prize, or these information programs where, you know, contests. And maybe, I don't know if you had any of those that you were fond of.
Well, I have a whole chapter on quiz shows. I was a huge fan of I was a little too young to appreciate Information Police, which my dad listened to. And I've since gotten some of the tapes, and it was kind of the high class, the intellectual quiz show of its day, kind of the Jeopardy of its day, with a lot of personalities on there, John Kieran and Oscar Levant and Alexander Wolcott, so real wits, you know. And then I also liked 20 Questions, and I liked Double or Nothing and Take It or Leave It, which was actually better known as the $64 question.
Which is a
$64,000 question,
right,
on TV.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I love quiz shows. I used to listen to those avidly. I listen to almost every genre, including soap operas, which we haven't even mentioned, which there were something, you know, very gripping about those as well.
And what the sponsors liked is that, you know, whether it was the soap opera or the detective show, there would always be the setup. Tune in next week. So, I mean, you wanted to find out what was going to happen to your favorite soap opera character.
Well, then they take 3 minutes to recap what had happened.
I know.
So even if you missed the last two or three days, you could catch up right away with the soap opera.
Well, you could always just call a friend and say, "Hey, what happened? You got to tell me. I got to know." Well, you mentioned Information Please, and there was a guy who was a real character. He actually played for the Red Sox, and his name was Mo Berg, and one of his most famous things. He was a very uncharacteristic baseball player. He actually was a linguist, and he worked for the CIA.
He
was a spy. Yes, he definitely was a spy.
He was
And he had a segment. He was on Information Please, and I guess
did he play for the Red Sox? I didn't know.
At the end of his career, he played for the Sox, and he was a character. He settled in Boston after he retired, and he was always, you find him in old bookstores, or sometimes I'd see him at Fenway Park, but.
Would actually see him, huh?
Yeah, and people would, you never really know what he was up to, you know. I guess he was very mysterious as far as some of this government work he had done.
There was a biography of him not long ago. He sounds like an interesting guy.
Yeah, a guy who's even a man of mystery pops up on radio, you know, kind of give you an idea of just how how big, you know, a medium it was. And what would you say really was the heyday? I mean, I know things were kind of winding down in the mid-50s, and I think Johnny Dollar was the last show to go off the air.
But '62, I think.
What period would you say was the apex of radio entertainment?
For me it was the 40s, because that's when I was growing up. But I think 30s, I don't know, 1940, right around there was probably the apex. That was when 38, I think, is when Orson Welles did the famous War of the Worlds broadcast.
Oh, this is a character.
I think right around in their late 30s to maybe 1945, after the war also.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Orson Welles because, you know, as a kid growing up, I'm just about 50, but as a kid, Orson Welles to me was always the guy who was on The Tonight Show or the Dean Martin roast. You know, he's this sort of jolly, chubby fellow, and, you know, they'd make references to different movies he had made, and I'd never even seen Citizen Kane then.
Yeah,
and then,
he became more of a personality, a character on TV, and
exactly,
doing wine commercials and stuff.
And then, you know, so I had an opportunity to listen to some of the Mercury Theater stuff, and everybody seems to remember the Mercury Theater production of War of the Worlds, but I listened to a few of the other productions, and I have a collection of some of the, I think he did a program that was a Dracula program, and he was really a fascinating character and amazingly talented. He was doing that stuff. He was 20, 21 years old. You know,
I know. He was an amazing guy. And I've heard a few, I've heard a few of the other Mercury Theater shows. They were just first-rate theater. And it's too bad he's just known for the one show, but he did, I don't know how long that was on the air, but He was really a one-man band. He wrote, directed, you know, did and acted. He did other shows besides that show. He was on The Shadow for a while.
Mm-hmm.
He was the voice of The Shadow, and then he did all kinds of character roles on TV. That's another thing. An actor could make a pretty good living by just going from show to show.
Right. Look at William Conrad, you know, another great
Conrad,
voice.
Of course, and anyone who could do more than one voice was was constantly employed.
I was listening to an episode of what was it? I think it was Gunsmoke, when I was just first getting interested again in old-time radio. And I said, gee, that guy sounds – well, it's Floyd the Barber. I mean, Howard McNair from – I remember from Andy and Barney. But he shows up everywhere, and he was a very – you know, he comes off as sort of a silly comic character with Andy Griffith. But he had a lot of depth, and he was a great – I thought he had a great voice, too. He really conveyed his character very well.
Yeah, well, radio really trained those guys. A lot of them went on to become movie stars, Richard Widmark and Agnes Moorehead or two, and there were many of them. A lot of them came out of the Mercury Theater Group, Joseph Cotton. But they were really well trained actors, and if they could act, you know, they needed to be full body actors, not just vocal actors. But a lot of them were, and they had great training in radio and doing all these shows and characters and voices.
One of the other things that I never really thought about, but sometimes they would try to take an actor from either stage or from film and turn him into a radio actor, and they'd have to build a little railing around the microphone because of their tendency to want to roam around, and you really just wanted to stand there and just stand and speak into the microphone and read. And there were some very good talents who never quite made it into radio. They just never quite got it. And then there were other people who had a good voice and were quick on their feet and good with the scripts,
and
they came on great.
Yeah, that's a little interesting little fact about radios. They did that because a lot of theater and movie actors would try to act with their, you know, using their arms and legs, and they would get out of mic range. So that was to keep them, you know, in mic range, so they didn't start acting all over the stage.
They probably should have tied him in a chair and had somebody turn the pages and the script for them.
So a lot of, as you said, a lot of movie stars, well, they did a lot. Movie stars were always doing guest roles, but a lot of them did do radio shows, and some of them, I was surprised to find out Jimmy Stewart had a radio show. Even Frank Sinatra had a radio character, detective.
Yep.
For a while, and a lot of them, everyone tried radio, you know, because it was the medium. Just as much as movies, and maybe more so in a way, because it was free, you know, and everybody listened every night.
You just had to
do a movie every day.
You just had to listen to the commercials. That's all you had to put up.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, another one of my, you know, pet peeves. I mean, I know there's a lot of good stuff on satellite radio and subscriptions, but I've always just felt, well, radio's supposed to be free. You know, it's just, you listen to the commercials. And you know, and the other thing that I found interesting and I never knew was that some programs they called sustaining programs that the networks would run. They knew they might not have a great sponsor or make a lot of money with them, but they were committed to putting out a you know, a decent product that they thought had some merit to it.
There was a lot of pride in that in those days, and it wasn't just all money grubbing. It was the networks really stood for something. And they liked the prestige they got. And so in that vein, we should probably mention a guy named Norman Corwin, who did a lot of his stuff didn't get commercial sponsorship. But he was a poet and a writer and a all-around guy, a writer, actor, producer. And he did a lot of kind of poetic documentaries.
Yeah, I don't know.
He used every element of radio, sound, music, voices. He would use comic actors in serious roles, Groucho Marx to be in a serious role. He really cut across all lines, and he was just a genius. He was radio, so kind of its soul in a way.
Now, you know, last I had heard, he was still alive and teaching at, a university
out
in California.
Well, I don't know if he's still teaching. He's 100 or 101.
Wow.
He was teaching up until a few years ago. I doubt if he is now. But
that's amazing.
He's still alive. He's an amazing guy, and I think when he turned 100, there were some stories on him, and he was teaching at UCLA. He was still in his late 90s, I think.
Well, earlier when we got started chatting, I was mentioning the Mystery Theater, and I always remember E.G. Marshall, and I remember them saying Hyman Brown, and I had no idea Hyman Brown. Well, I just thought he was a guy, you know, I didn't know anything.
Uh-huh.
And then, Hyman Brown is the Hyman Brown from Inner Sanctum, and
He created Inner Sanctum and several other shows.
And he did a very good job, I thought, bringing back some very good programming with some pretty good actors and, you know, putting it on. I think it was CBS Radio Mystery Theater. And I enjoyed that as a kid. I thought that was so novel. And it was something you could listen to in the background. You didn't have to go down and sit in front of the TV. You know, you could move around your room and you could do other things.
I think if kids today just even knew that these tapes still existed, they would really... I think teenagers or young adults would really love this stuff because it's a totally new way to be entertained, and they don't even know this. There was such a thing as radio other than what they grew up with, which was news and, you know, rock and pop music.
Right, and it's a good way to be trained how to listen, too. I went to a local school up here, and I brought a few old tube radios to show them this was what entertainment was, and I had brought some programs. So I played a program. I believe I played A Christmas Carol, and I think it was Ronald Coleman in the lead as Scrooge. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to get them into the right frame of mind to listen to this, and I said, you know, you really have to be quiet, close your eyes, think hard, you know, listen to the voices, listen to the sound effects, and see if you can put yourself back in time into Dickensian England. And this one little girl, it was funny, she was listening to me, and she had never seen these kind of radios, so I went to play the CD, and she closed her eyes, and she put her head down on her desk, and I said, she got it, you know, 9 years old, and she actually got it.
That's very inspiring.
And it was funny because when it was all over, she said, I felt like I was there. I said, well, that's...
Yeah, well, it would open up a whole vista to them. That's the great thing about radio is that it really used your imagination, and, you know, it's funny because you can, as you say, you really have to listen closely because it was all word-driven, and you can't, like, you can watch TV and listen and read a magazine at the same time, but you can't do that with radio. And the other thing, great thing about radio, it was so portable. I mean, you could
have one
in every room, or you could just take it to the beach. You know, you can't do that
with
TV.
Well, you know, the other thing too was, and I'm surprised with a lot of my old sets, even though they may be smaller table sets, they have a lot of volume, and you can turn that up and hear that on the whole first floor. And, you know, that was probably a very commonly done thing as somebody was doing their housework or doing chores around the house. Or they'd stick the radio in the window if you wanted to listen to the baseball game and you're out, you know, washing the car or doing something out in the yard. So, well, it was certainly a different time. And in some ways, you know, I know there were a lot of programs that weren't that great, but there was a lot of very good entertainment. And I really...
A lot of it was not that great, but the stuff we remember, and I think most of it was pretty good.
And I think the stuff that we remember and talk about and still are impressed by is a testament to how good it was. I don't know how much I would see today on TV that I would be talking about 40, 50, 60 years later. So time will tell us that. Jerry, I really appreciate you taking some time tonight and coming on the show. I enjoyed chatting about the golden age. Well, maybe we can have you on.
I'd like to do it again.
Well, we'd be glad to have you back, and we have an email address set up for the radio program, which is tubetalk1@gmail.com. So if anybody has anything they'd like to have us discuss or talk about in the world of old-time radio, we'd be glad to consider covering it. And I'd just like to say goodnight, Jerry, and thanks again for being on the show.
Okay, Paul, thank you, and good night.
Good night now. Bye-bye.
Made the night a little brighter wherever he would go.
He would go,
the old lamplighter of long, long ago. His snowy hair was so much whiter beneath the candle glow.
Candle glow.
You'd hear the patter of his feet as he came toddling down the street. His smile would hide a lonely heart, you see. If there were sweethearts in the park, he'd pass a lamp and leave it dark, remembering the days that used to be. For he recalls when dreams were new, he loved someone who loved him too, who walks with him alone in memory. He made the night a little brighter wherever he would go.
He would go,
the old the night a little brighter. Wherever he would go,
he would go.
The if you look up at the sky, you'll understand the reason why the little stars at night are all aglow. He turns them on when night is here. He turns them off when dawn is near. The little man we loved of long ago.
The Old Lamplighter. That was Sammy Kaye and his orchestra.
Oh, by Jove and by Jehovah, you have set my heart aflame.
And to you, you Casanova, my reactions are the same.
I would sing the tender verses, but the flair, alas, I lack.
I'll go on, try to versify, and I'll versify back.
Well, let me see now. Cherry pies ought to be you.
Autumn skies ought to be you.
Mr. Pulitzer's prize ought to be you.
Romeo in disguise ought to be you.
Columbine ought to be you.
Sparkling wine ought to be you.
All of Beethoven's nine ought to be you.
Every Will Shakespeare line ought to be you.
You are so enticing, I'm starting to shake.
You are just the icing to put on my cake.
You mean I'm yummy? Heaven's blue ought to be you.
Heaven too ought to be you.
Everything super do ought to be you. Asphodels ought to be you.
Orson Welles ought to be you.
Ankles like Kit Cornell's ought to be you.
Towels from Ritz Hotels ought to be you.
Sweet Snow White ought to be you.
Ambrose Light.
Hey, that's good.
Ought to be you.
Eleanor, wrong or right, ought to be you.
Errol Flynn, loose or tight.
Watch it.
Ought to be you.
You are so exciting, I can't even laugh. I want to top that one.
If you're fond of biting, I'll bite you in half.
To continue, Whistler's Ma ought to be you.
Elliot's Pa ought to be you.
Everything hip hurrah ought to be you.
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 Cherry Pies Ought to Be You, Rosemary Clooney and Frank Sinatra from 1951.
And it's time for a song, and if one of you guys don't sing, I'm going to.
Oh, no, not that.
Yes, I'd rather listen to Valley than you.
And I'd rather listen to Sinatra.
Go ahead, Junior, thrill the people. Boost him up to the mic, Fred. Ups. Ups a daisy, Frankie boy. I'll get it in, or else.
When they begin the begin, it brings back the sound of music so tender. It brings back a night of tropical splendor. It brings back a memory evergreen. I'm with you once more under the stars, and down by the shore in orchestras playing. Even the palms seem to be swaying when they begin the begin. Live it again is past all endeavor, except when the tune clutches my heart, and there we are. never sing never, never too far. What moments divine, what rapture serene. Till clouds came along to disperse the joys we have tasted. And now when I hear people curse the chance that was wasted, I know but too well what they mean. So don't let them begin the beginning. Let the love that was once a fire remain. Let it sleep like the dead desire I only remember when they begin the beginning. Oh, yes, let them begin the beginning. Make them play till the stars that were there. Did you whisper to me once more, darling, I love you? And we suddenly know what heaven we're in when they begin the beginning. When they begin.
That was just a really great arrangement of that Cole Porter song, Begin the Beguine. That was from an Armed Forces Radio Service mail call program. And in the CD that I got that from, it apologizes for the sound quality because apparently, I don't know exactly how they go about remastering it. They couldn't smooth out all the little hiss and all the little bumps in it. But Sinatra's voice in those days, I understand a little bit more after listening to that, why he was such a phenomenon. Here's the Mills Brothers with Standing on the Corner, and I played a version of this on a different show, a different night of Tube Talk, and it was by the Four Freshmen. Let's hear how it sounds by the Mills Brothers.
Standing on the corner, watching all the girls go by. Standing on the corner, watching all the girls go by.
Brother, you don't know a nicer occupation.
Matter of fact, neither do I. Then standing on the corner, watching all the girls, watching all the girls, watching all the girls go by. I'm the cat that got the green. Haven't got a girl, but I can dream. Haven't got a girl, but I can wish.
So I take me down to Main Street, and that's where I select my imaginary day.
Standing on the corner, watching all the girls go by. Standing on the corner, giving all the girls the eye.
Brother, if you've got a rich imagination,
give it a whirl, give it a try. Try standing on the corner, watching all the girls, watching all the girls, watching all the girls go by.
Standing on the corner, watching all the girls.
What are you standing there for?
Brother, you don't know an icy occupation.
Matter of fact,
neither do I.
Then standing on the corner, watching all the girls, watching all the girls, watching all the girls. Going by.
Well, that was so nice and very smooth. Thanks for listening to the show. We hope you've enjoyed it. We hope you enjoyed our interview tonight with Jerry Nachman, author of Raised on Radio. If you'd like to learn a little bit more about the world of old-time radio, the actors, the sound effect men, all the different actors, a lot of the different shows, it's a great chronicle, Raised on Radio by Gerald Nachman. And we'd like to thank you for listening. And if you'd like to get in touch with us and tell us if you enjoyed the show, you can reach us at tubetalk1@gmail.com. Once again, thanks for listening. Good night now.